The Tom Woods Show, episode 1020.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Men, get yourselves an excellent shave at an outstanding price with Harry's and get your $13 trial set for free. Just cover shipping. Check it out at harrys.com/woods. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here with Pete Earle. We're going to talk about his little book, very little book, called A Century of Anarchy. It is a case study of more or less statelessness. We're looking at a small slice of territory in northwestern Europe in the 19th century, and we're going to talk about that, and I love case studies, and I love talking about statelessness, so this, you know, come on now, this is tailor-made for the show. Pete, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Tom.
I read your, well, I have to say it's rather a small book. It may be the smallest book I have featured on the show, but on the other hand, I've been promoting the almost 1,000-page book by Professor Casey on the history of political thought. So in a way, this is a welcome relief, but it's called A Century of Anarchy, which makes you want to read this darn thing, and it's a case study, and man, do we need case studies. So let's start off, for anybody who may be scandalized, who has heard, let's say, only selective episodes of this show, may be scandalized by the use of the word anarchy. Can we clarify what you're talking about in when you're speaking about so-called anarchy in this book?
Sure. So what we're not talking about is wanton chaos, bloodshed, that sort of thing. We're talking about a social spontaneous order where voluntary interaction and cooperation without any sort of centralized rulemaking or bureaucratic structures are in operation. And the obvious example of the latter description would be states, governments, that sort of thing, ruling boards, which would impose order from the top down. Here we're speaking of anarchy as bottom up, spontaneously ordered, cooperative dynamics within a society or a group.
So really what you're talking about is the extension of the market order that we're familiar with and that many people support just a little bit more broadly to extend farther out into the farthest reaches of society.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's talk about case studies, because even libertarians who aren't anarchists nevertheless get the question, where can you in the world can you show me an example of this actually working? And sometimes they flail about to come up with an example. Well, in particular, examples of statelessness are even more scarce. You can find them, but they're scarce, and oftentimes there's relatively little work done on them, or what work has been done is done through the lens of historians who just can't get what's going on there. So you've taken a very obscure example that I had never heard of before and used that as a case study. So first of all, set the stage. What is this place you're talking about, and what were the unique historical circumstances that brought it about?
So Moresnet is today the city of Kelmis in southeastern Belgium near the German border. And after the Napoleonic Wars, which raged from the very beginning of the 19th century, say 1803 through 1813, upon that conclusion, there was the characteristic splitting up of spoils and territories and such. And the Congress of Vienna was where all that was codified. And what happened was the idea was that in certain places, no nation during the peace process, in certain places, no nation should dominate another. We're talking here about Prussia, France, the Netherlands. Belgium wasn't yet independent this time, and England had a role. And so, what they decided was they would partition this area, and one area in particular was a sticking point, and that was that in the lower, again, the southeastern portion of what's today Belgium, there was an area where there was a zinc mine. And zinc was extremely rare and extremely precious at that time. And so it was decided that rather than go to war again or leave one country in control of it, that a corporation by the name of Vieille Montagne, which I'm not a French speaker, but it means the old mountain, they ran a zinc mine there. And the area around it would be designated as what was called a condominium. And a condominium in those terms meant an essentially governmentless or what we would call like a neutral zone, that sort of thing. And so Prussia and the Netherlands and later Belgium were jointly overseeing this small patch of land, which was, I think it was just over 900 square acres. It was a triangle-shaped piece of land in which there was a mining facility, and there were also barracks and a hospital for the mining employees who lived there. And within that area, there were no military forces of the surrounding nations allowed to. No military forces were allowed to enter, and they were overseen by sort of a board of individuals from the various surrounding countries. But it turned out over time that out of sight was very much out of mind, and there's very little actual managing going on by the political officials.
Now, tell me something about those political officials. What were they called, and what were they actually doing? There was actually a period for several years, I guess, in the 1880s where there weren't any. So I'm interested in what were they supposed to do? What did they actually do?
I would guess that they were in charge of making sure – I think they all had their eyes on each other. I think the idea was that the board – they oversaw one individual who was a burgomeister, which was essentially like a mayor. And there was another individual who was the, I guess you would call him the lone police officer or whatever, who they jokingly referred to as the Secretary of War. He would walk around in his uniform all day long. But most of the time, the burgomeister and the single police officer would spend their time playing pool and drinking at the pub. And over the course of this 100-year period, there were only four different burgomeisters, and they tended to hold this position for a very long time. I think the average is about 35 years each. And there was a period between 1882 and 1885, I believe it was, where there was actually no one was designated. And I mean, I think that points to exactly what the overseeing board was doing, which is very little. Because they would appoint that individual. The administrators, I think they were there to keep an eye on one another. And essentially, you know, as long as the mine was just churning out zinc, there was really no reason to interfere.
Do we have any idea what the population figures were?
Oh yeah. So when Moresnet was originally set up as a neutral zone, there were about 250 miners and their families there. And that number just skyrocketed over the years. By the time the U.S. Civil War began around 1860, the number had climbed to, I believe it was 2,600. And by the time World War I broke out, it was almost 5,000 people squeezed into that tiny territory.
Are there any peculiarities about either the topography of the region, or anything that makes the territory unique that might have some bearing on how this experiment worked out?
Absolutely. So the area is on the side of a hill. Essentially, the mountain and the mine are on the side of a hill. It's very obscure. I write in one part of the book that if you had a map and you were a crumb fell from what you might be eating, it would obscure the location. It wasn't actually on most maps. And so one of the reasons why the experiment was successful is that it just wasn't very widely known. I believe that most of the people who arrived there came by word of mouth. And the most frequent way that people seem to have found out about Moresnet was around the 1860s, there was an attempt, or 1870s, there was an attempt to set up a private postal service. And philately, the collecting of rare stamps, brought some people's attention to the existence of Moresnet. But even then, I found an ad in a philatelist periodical from the, I believe it was 1870s, where in France it said, we're not even sure where this place is, but these are some pretty cool stamps. There's that, and the fact that There weren't any railroads running directly to Quilmes and that sort of thing. And it was deep in the forest that led to this remaining pretty obscure outside of a group of, like I said, a network of people who I guess, spoke and attracted incrementally larger groups to this area.
All right. I want to talk about prosperity and questions like that and how it all came to an end in just a minute. But first, let's thank our sponsor. Folks, here's a novel approach. You don't like the price of a product and you think you can do a better job? Buy your own factory and start making it yourself. That's what Jeff and Andy did. They were just two regular guys and they were fed up with buying overpriced razors. So they bought their own German factory that had over 100 years of blade making experience to make sure they would get the highest quality blade. Harry's offers their blades at half the price of the leading five-blade razor. They sell directly to you over the internet, and you're going to love the experience. The product itself is excellent. I've had lots of problems with blades in the past, but I get a beautiful, smooth shave with Harry's. It's a great system overall, which is why when I was looking for a Christmas gift for my old friend Michael Malice, I got him a beautiful Harry's shave set. Well, you can claim your free trial offer from Harry's. It's a $13 value for free when you sign up. Just cover three smackers for shipping, and you get a weighted ergonomic razor handle, five precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. So to grab that, just head over to harrys.com/woods. That's harrys.com/woods.
One of the things you point out about this place is that it was a prosperous place. It did fairly well. And you feel, as you know, as an anti-state guy, compelled to point out something about the extent of taxation, regulation, the burdens of government in connection with the prosperity, because there may be some relationship between the two characteristics.
Absolutely. So one of the things is that Moresnet was essentially, when it was set out in its initial days, it was sort of a frozen period of time in which it existed. So taxes were set at the level in 1815 or so when the border markets were put up, and they never changed. And additionally, without any sort of regulations or anything like that from the surrounding governments, from the overseers, people were pretty much free to do what they wanted to. And so along the main street in Quilmes, one account says that by the 1880s, there were 60 or 70 restaurants and bars, other eating establishments, a bunch of farms, a large dairy operation, some breweries, and that sort of thing. So there were no fetters on these folks, and nobody, certainly not the overseers, tried to stop them. There were a few attempts later, one of which was when I believe it was King Leopold of Belgium shut down the casinos. A number of them attempted to relocate into Quilmes, and that word did spread pretty wide, and the Moresnetians were threatened that if they persisted in attempting to open gaming halls, or if they allowed the individuals who wanted to move their operations there to do so, that they might be shut down and they might lose their independence. So absolutely. I mean, there's a direct tie between economic liberty and overall, or more broadly, social liberty, and that was very much in effect from the beginning.
Now, you were saying that zinc played a key role in terms of what kinds of production took place there. But then, as with any mine, eventually, you know, all good things do come to an end, as I believe happened in the 1880s. So I would think there'd be some people looking at this story saying, well, you know, they had this amazing resource, so maybe that gave it an artificial advantage. But that resource was more or less depleted eventually, and the thing did still continue along. And because you can always diversify into other things.
Absolutely. They had, if they had been successful in opening up the casinos, I mean, they might still be there today. I mean, of course, that that steps around the sticky issues of World Wars I and II, but certainly they were very resilient, and they were able to sustain the quality of life they enjoyed. In which, by the way, another thing is that prices in Moresnet were, on average, 10 to 20% cheaper than in the surrounding areas. I found a after I published the book, I found a list of prices. And you notice that between Prussia, which by then, which by the early part of the 20th century was Germany, prices were consistently higher. I think that had a lot to do with the fact that that the taxation was low. Taxation was set at the same level for almost 100 years. And there were basically no fees and no tithings or anything like that. People were, you know, setting prices, you know, at market clearing levels, and there was no you know, regulation, that sort of thing, to hinder with the free transaction and the freedom of commerce in that small area.
Now, although I consider it to be a bit quixotic, it's still an interesting part of the story to mention Esperanto and the experiment involving that.
Yeah. So one of the figures that that factors prominently into the history of Moore's Net, especially after 1860, is a fellow by the name of Wilhelm Molly. He was the physician who was hired to be the doctor to the families and such who were, and the miners and such who resided in Moore's Net. But he became a sort of a local hero when he defeated a cholera outbreak among the agricultural folks who had pigs and you know, livestock. So he was, like many physicians of his age, something of a polymath. And one of his interests was languages, and in particular, Esperanto. And I guess for anyone who doesn't know, Esperanto was a project undertaken by an academic named Zamenhof, in which the idea was that conflict in human events, in particular wars, were the product of problems in translation and problems in relating to other people socially. And so if the idea went that if there was some universal language, which was a hybrid of all existing languages, people would over time get along better, and they would, you know, sort of reduce hostilities and tensions between people and cultures and such. Anyway, Molly had an ongoing correspondence with several academics who were proponents of and practitioners of Esperanto, and the idea came up in the early part of the 20th century that perhaps one road for Moore's Net's future would be to become the sort of homeland of Esperanto, and they went as far as to declare some form of independence, although we don't know to what extent it was recognized. We do know that there were several media outlets and such who turned up in 1908 for the culmination and the sort of celebration of that effort. And with that, Moore's Net began to attempted to rebuild itself, Amakajo. And Amakajo is the Esperanto word for place of friendship.
Pete, before we get to the story of how this all came to an end this century or so, how did you find out about it?
So, like so many other writing projects of mine, I had something completely different in mind, and I went off on a weird tangent, and I discovered this. I believe I was writing an article, researching an article rather, to write about the currency reformers of ancient Rome. We hear a lot about the inflationary periods, but we rarely hear about those handful of emperors and such who attempted to shore up the denarius. And in so doing, I was taken down a rabbit hole of currencies, and I discovered the Moore's Netian franc, which I thought was curious, hadn't heard of it before. And that opened up this huge series of additional readings and such, which they just captivated me and kept me from writing the article on currency reformers of Rome for about 2 years.
So, all right, now we get to the part where we see the absorption of this place. Let's find out how that happened, and then I want to wrap up with some concluding thoughts.
The absorption of Moore's Net into ultimately Belgium.
Right.
Right. Okay. So Moore's Net began to call itself Amakajo. We're now talking about a place where there are 5,000 people living there. They come from as far away as the U.S. There were reports that there was an individual there who was Chinese, all over Europe, and World War I breaks out. And so there are several different accounts, and two of them are diametrically opposed. One has Germany invading and peacefully occupying Moore's Net, Another has some sort of combat going on, some Morsnetians being killed, that sort of thing. At any rate, Morsnet was under German occupation, and it went from a place, I mean, you could see very clearly that with the sudden overtaking and the German attempt to separate people who are German from those who are Belgian and such, which was unsuccessful because by then everyone was living together and had there were families of different national background. A reporter speaks about how it took hours to cross 12 feet of space to get from one place to another in Morsnet, to enter Morsnet. And so that to me is highly emblematic of the radical change that undertook when governments, in probably their most distinct form, war states, occupied this this essentially anarchic commune. I don't want to say commune, community.
My thinking is that probably the lessons we can draw from this, or the value we can derive from it, comes in certain specific areas. Like, for example, that you could have a community very lightly governed, if governed at all, with a very free economy, without a heavy police presence. And by the way, in an anarchic society, you'd still have a police presence, but who knows how numerous it would, you know, how the policemen would be and what they'd be doing and all that. But anyway, you can draw a lot of interesting stuff from this. But wouldn't people say, look, it's a very, very small, isolated community. It's a very unique set of circumstances. And then when push came to shove, it lost its independence anyway. So people might say its value for us as an example is not so significant. What do you think?
I couldn't disagree more. I mean, what we're seeing here is that what Morsnet, like some certain other examples, the walled city of Kowloon, the American West, there's some others. What it demonstrates the possibilities that statelessness have, and the fact that that they were overrun by an invading army is I think people who say that shows that statelessness can't work are seeing it upside down. We're seeing, to me, that's an example of how states destroy prosperity, that sort of thing. And the type of destruction that people usually attribute to the concept of anarchy is the violence, disorder, all that stuff. You know, that only arrived when Germany arrived. That only comes when states arrive. And so, I mean, the argument to me is not to give up on spontaneous order because of the existence of states. It should be to give up on states and let spontaneous order, you know, spread more widely, or attempt to at least.
Well, I'm going to make sure and link on this page for this episode, which will be tomwoods.com/1020, to some other episodes where we've fleshed out some of the theoretical questions that might occur to people about this. I'll put that in there as a nice supplement to this conversation. You can actually get Pete's book here called A Century of Anarchy. You can get that on Amazon. And of course, I will link to that too on the show notes page. And, are you working on anything else that's going to surprise us these days?
Been busy with work and such, but I do have a few irons in the fire. Nothing much to speak about yet. There's a long-term project of mine is a book I've been working on about the Great Depression, about an aspect of it that really hasn't been spoken about or investigated much. But that's been working on that for years, and it may take a while longer.
Okay. All right. Well, good to know. Well, thanks so much for your time today. It's a very interesting example. My guess would be, have you done any other podcast interviews on this topic?
Some time ago I had, but not recently.
Okay. Because I was thinking, I don't know if I could, because surely you would have been promoting this, but I was wondering if I could be the only podcast talking about this. But, well, I'm certainly in the top 20. I got to be.
So, I appreciate it.
Yeah, so it's an honor at least to be there. All right, thanks a lot, Pete. Appreciate your good work on this.
Thanks, Tom. Take care.
All right, a couple things to tell you. First, make sure and go back and listen to episode 1000. I did finally release it. That was the live episode we did in Orlando with the big crowd and the special guests, and it was a tremendous time. And if you miss it, you're going to be very unhappy. So tomwoods.com/1000. Now, of course, because the sound was being recorded through the soundboard, through all the microphones, you can hear us very well, but you don't hear the crowd as loudly as you otherwise would if you had mics hanging over the crowd. So if you happen to see on Facebook or anything clips of it taken by people standing in the crowd with their phones, you'll hear the audience was roaring. I mean, they sound like they're, like, for example, when that video was running at the beginning, they sound like they're sort of politely cheering. They are roaring. The energy in that room was absolutely unbelievable. And even with the muted audience audio, it still manages to come through from time to time. So just imagine what it was really like there. Amazing. I do not want you to miss that episode. Second thing is, I have a listener who has started a baseball website. So if you like baseball, you will like screwballtimes.com. And, you know, I like to talk about these sites as they come out that listeners create. But I don't know how to describe screwballtimes.com, except it will make you laugh. If you like baseball and you like laughing, then I'm just going to say check out screwballtimes.com, because he's got funny items. I don't want to spoil it for you, but it's laid out nicely and it's all meant to just be lighthearted and fun for baseball fans. I'll leave it there. When you get there, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. The headlines are, I mean, the headline, like, for example, this headline: Brewers within one game of Rockies in wild card with zero games remaining. I mean, just kind of off the wall commentary. So check it out at screwballtimes.com. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/1020. Of course, how did he get this free publicity for his site, the creator? Well, the answer is he used my link for Bluehost. That's right. And then I promote your site, link to it for some SEO juice for you. Throw you into my private bloggers group on Facebook if you're interested in that. I have two private Facebook groups. This is one of them, and it'll help you when you have occasional troubles, and we all try to help each other in there. Plus, a couple of dozen video tutorials to get you up and running as a blogger. How do you get all these free goodies? Check out tomwoods.com/publicity and get your web hosting through there, and I'll give you all these goodies. All right, now remember, next week is the Contra Cruise, the cruise that Bob Murphy and I co-host every year. So we're going to have fewer episodes than usual. Last year, I think I managed to do a whole slate of five episodes, but this has been crazy traveling for me lately. And we did release the 1,000th episode this week, and that's very long. So I'm just going to do a few episodes next week. And then when I come back, we got all kinds of fun stuff, because Ron Paul has a new book out, The Revolution After 10 Years. We're going to talk to Ron Paul about his new book, and some other fun guests that you have heard of are going to make their way over to the Tom Woods Show. So I will see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.